This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes Sinclair. Welcome to the show. Well, folks, we have a special guest. This is Christiana Brenton, and I'm going to share a bit of her background just so you understand the kind of person we're talking about. Australian born, now lives in London, has helped pioneer a fundamentally different way for podcasting to happen around the world. And she is the co-founder and the chief revenue officer for Flight Studio. If Flight Studio sounds something like in the ether that you're familiar with, it's because it's the shop that looks after The Diary of a CEO by Stephen Bartlett, not to mention a whole host of other titles and other ventures sitting in behind that. It is such a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you, Christiana. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Phil. I'm very excited to be here. That was a very gracious introduction.
Not at all. Well, let's dive in, because as we were just talking about, you and I think, have not only at least one relationship in common, we also have a fundamental love for being generous when it comes to trying to forge a long-term partnership. And I suspect our philosophy is very, very similar. But before we get to that, let's dive into your backstory, because it will be familiar to some who have gone through media and understand media, but it might not be to many others. So what is the Christiana backstory?
What a question. I actually think I might start with something that, again, it's only in hindsight that I've realized has had such a formidable impact on my life and career. But I'm actually the youngest of eight kids.
Eight children, born
and bred in Melbourne. My parents were a doctor and a nurse, and then they became therapists together. And if I think about that earliest context, so it's one of the questions that Stephen always asks his first guest, how did your earliest context shape you? Being the youngest of eight kids has set the scene for an awareness of, let's say, debate, curiosity, teamwork, observation, being the youngest, observing all of their paths and, you know, steps that they've taken, diplomacy, and really independence. Because, of course, if you're going to choose to have eight kids, you can't necessarily, let's say, have the dedicated attention, right? But what a gift. And not to mention, I'd say, work ethic. Because again, if you know, set the scene of a teacher and a nurse raising eight kids in Australia, obviously with that comes, I suppose, some socioeconomic challenges just by sheer, you know, volume of numbers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't realize at the time, but my parents have instilled me with such a strong work ethic, which is something that I think ultimately scales every single business.
Yep.
No matter where you are. So I thought that was quite interesting looking back, and not to mention youngest of eight kids, but a highly passionate family about politics. So left-leaning.
Interesting.
A lot of debate and discussion all the time around politics and philosophy, likely because my dad was a teacher for many years. And then that I was probably influenced there. I then went on to Melbourne University to do a degree of political science. And then did a master's of media and communications. But again, I suppose my earlier years in deciding where I would end up professionally was, again, I was really gravitated towards curiosity, analytical thinking, trying to understand multiple sides of the debate and the equation, as you have to do in politics to really understand how to potentially position your point of view. And you don't necessarily see a direct correlation between political science and, let's say, sales and media partnerships. But again, it's only in reflection. I suppose at the time I didn't realize.
Yeah.
And now I've been able to connect those dots that, wow, it's one and of the same, because it's about being deeply analytical, deeply curious, trying to understand the perspective and motivations behind every person. It's been an interesting, I'd say, connector. And I know you spoke to my co-founder, Georgie Holt, and she mentioned the same, that she studied politics. And I thought, isn't that interesting that we've both been connected in our curiosity there? Like a lot of people, though, I fell into my first media job. So very passionate about politics. And then I did, of course, the Master of Global Media Communications. And then I found my first role at Nova Entertainment in Australia. Mm-hmm. And that was, gosh, I think I was 22, 23, starting my first job as an account manager. And again, this you know, beautiful thing when you look back and realize, wow, how defining that really was. We weren't calling it the creator economy then, but that was certainly my first introduction to working in the creator economy. Nerve Entertainment, I'm sure, is somewhat familiar if this is a predominantly Australian audience. You know, they were
very
a traditional
broadcast
network that have then gone on to diversify into digital podcasts. And when I started at Nova, I was immediately drawn to their branded content division called Create, which was led by another phenomenal female mentor I've had in my life called Kate Day. And so, you know, I immediately saw what we had, I suppose, to offer our partners and our clients. And one of them, let's say, was like the Spots and Dots, the kind of reach and scale campaigns. And yes, they drove a functional element for our partners, but I absolutely gravitated towards the power of creativity. And really, really loved working in that creative team, which I think, again, sets the scene of enabling me to, help kind of leverage creativity to scale other teams when I left Nova Entertainment. So that was, my earliest context and professionally speaking. So I started in Melbourne as an account manager, then worked up my ranks to a account director, and then, you know, started to lead teams in Melbourne and then moved over to Sydney. And Nova Entertainment many years ago had a joint venture with a company called Acast.
Yes, it did.
So as you can imagine, they're a traditional broadcast network, and then we're diversifying their offering. And we signed a deal with Acast, and then I was first exposed to podcasting, honestly, it may have been, 8, 9 years ago now, through that joint venture, and I just became absolutely obsessed with the medium.
Yep.
Keeping in mind that this is a, let's say, salesperson, I actually hate that word, salesperson, but I had felt somewhat limited to the Breakfast and Drive lineup in terms of working with creators. And then, oh my gosh, here's a pool of, I think at the time they had 50,000 creators on the platform. And again, in radio, traditionally speaking, you're kind of limited to short form. And then here was this medium that provided long-form, nuanced opinion, perspective and debate. Going back to my interest and passion in politics, I was just so drawn to that channel. And for a couple of reasons, and I think this is something that ultimately connects Georgie Holt, as I mentioned, my business partner and Stephen, is that, wow, I felt how powerful. This is one of the only channels in the world that has such a positive psychological impact on the end user and the consumer. And I have long been resistant of social media. I ultimately use it now we use it in our company as a strategic kind of accelerant for audience discovery and growth. But I think there's a lot of kind of negative implications in social media in terms of doom scrolling, comparison crisis, lifting the beauty standards, and, people spending chronically way too much time online. So then here we have a long-form medium in podcasting that doesn't have that effect, that, the more time you spend with the channel, it has a net positive impact on your collective human consciousness and psychology. And I was so drawn to that. I thought, wow, what a gift, this medium, that the more I consume, the more I'm learning and I'm actually feeling better about myself. And so that was probably the personal attraction to the channel. And then working with advertisers my whole life, we started to test campaigns in podcasting, so testing host reads. I was actually responsible for the first ever podcast partnership in the Australian market. It was Stephen Fry's Seven Deadly Sins in Mercedes-Benz did the first sponsorship. So we did, one of those integrated 60 to 90 second host reads, kind of the bread and butter of the podcasting economy. And we deployed various different measurement solutions, and I saw the results and I thought, wow,
there's
the comparative results to
traditional
broadcast versus podcasting because of the captive audience, how deeply engaged people are at that time as well, very low ad loads when it first began. And we saw the ability not only to drive a brand equity impact for clients, but drive bottom funnel direct response actions, which was something that was traditionally a lot harder to prove out in broadcast radio. So, I think about like my head and my heart were so aligned to this new channel. I thought it was adding such psychological positive impact in the world, and then it was delivering results for our clients and partners, and I was just captivated and obsessed every day since. And then, I always wanted to move overseas. I had, I think, that, I suppose, healthy ambition, or let's say curiosity instilled with me from a young age. So Nova Entertainment knew about that and were very supportive. And I actually told Peter Charlton at the time, who's now the CEO of Nomura Entertainment. He's there. That I wanted to move to London, that I would really like his help and support in encouraging me to get there. Again, talk about the power of partnerships rather than resigning, being open and transparent about my intentions and my motivations and what's driving me. And Pete was a huge enabler of that, really obviously encouraged me to have the conversation with the Acast executive team at the time via the joint venture. And I actually first interviewed with their CEO and COO. I don't know if you know, well, Ross Adams is the previous CEO of Acast, and then and Oscar. I think this is quite interesting as well, and you can cut some of this out if we're going for too long, but when
please go. I've got so many more questions now. But yeah,
there's a lot here, so interject as you wish, because, yeah, I think that at least context is one of the most important things that's probably going to impact people's career and the you know, choices they make, which I'm sure we'll get to. But when I first interviewed at Acast, it was actually for their New York office. I had wild ambitions of moving to the US and moving to New York. I just thought it was such a dynamic city. And anyone that is excited and passionate by commercial partnerships, it's the biggest market in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And that's absolutely where I wanted to be. And I had interviewed, and it was all really positive. All the signals were really positive about a role being available. And then through various different reasons, they said, no, we actually don't have space in our US team. So despite going through that whole process, you know, the US wasn't meant to be at that moment in time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, instead of being, I suppose, disappointed or deflated, I just pivoted. And I said, what about London? And then so I just pursued the London team, made a connection with Joe Copeman, who is still in Acast London today, and interviewed and was fortunate enough to get that role. So in 2019, I moved from Australia, from Sydney at the time, over to the London office. Again, I think the power of a pivot. You know, I had a plan. I had a goal of US, but it wasn't to be at that time. But, you know, that's okay. I had two options: to stay in Australia and feel deflated, or to find another way in and another way through, playing the long game, which you spoke to at the top of this call.
Definitely.
Joined Acast in 2019, and they were at a really unique period in their growth as well. This was pre-IPO. They were just starting to mature their sales operations. They were doing a lot of sponsorship and 30-second audio ad sales, but were yet to fully unlock the power of creativity. So I really helped to launch and scale out their creative division, again, from the learnings of Create in Australia and all of the mentorship from Kate Day. And then we really built this phenomenal creative partnership division, and they've gone on to win many awards. And again, that was recognizing that we have these podcast creators, and why are we limiting our partnership thinking to just the podcast? A lot of these creators have social channels, have opportunities for live experiences. They have, you know, they're providing value to their audience far beyond, let's just say, podcast RSS. So again, let's think bigger. And that's quite commonplace now. But at the time in 2019, it was still predominantly sponsorship and ads. And I don't think people were really bringing like those bigger, that big creativity and 360 approach to the partnership. So that was quite, I suppose, successful in scaling their revenue across their IPO era, really unlocked by creativity and unlocking bigger budgets through that creativity. In 2020, so I was at Acast for, let's say, about a year, and then I met Georgie Holt. She was the managing director of Acast at the time, so was leading our UK operations, and at that point I was in the leadership team across sales and commercial partnerships, and that was an instantaneous bond. If we talk about ideological alignment, which I think is a really important part of partnerships. Again, interject at any point here, because that's a long...
you're good. I mean, we do have to go back to this idea, which I think is massively important, about the psychological impact of long-form content. So for anyone who... I mean, we've all consumed ads. We've all been part of, you know, maybe not people who come after our generation, but certainly the ones that are in our generation and ones before were part of broadcast television, we're part of broadcast radio, and all of these things survived on short form ads and a different style of attention. And now, and I've heard Stephen speak about this before, when it comes to a long form conversation where people can actually tell their story, there is a fundamentally different wellness, I think, that comes with that, as you've alluded to. Now, you can look at some of the biggest podcasts in the world, whether it's Peter Attia's medical podcast show that he does himself. He's publishing huge volumes of deeply researched, very rigorous content to help people just understand more about what's happening in health and well-being. And then everyone that comes through your shop is also telling their story and leveraging that as well. But at some point, all of this needs a commercial equation to work. And I think the thing that I'm very, very interested in from your point of view is, yes, it's one thing to sell. And I actually think selling is one of the most misunderstood art forms in the world. But when it comes to you trying to pair these two things together, you saw an early trend, you knew how to sell, you knew what creativity would bring to the fore, and you were early. When I think a lot of people would have gone, yeah, I'm not sure. I think the podcasting thing's going to come and go. Now we're talking, I don't think it's unfair to say that Flight Studio is probably the preeminent podcast company in the world right now. Let's just hang that on a hook for a minute. I think it's one of those things where people didn't realize what was happening. And you mentioned 2019, but that wasn't that long ago. We're not talking back in the 90s here. This was very recent. We did all have a bit of a wobble during COVID, but you look at what's happened now, I think that the future is almost fast forwarded to see the real value in what you've created over there.
I mean, yeah, I think so. Podcasting in and of itself has gone through rapid evolution, if you really think about it. So back when I started in the industry and before co-founding Flight Studio, and, you know, it was a singular audio RSS experience. And now, you know, we're thinking about what is the definition of a podcast. I was in LA at an Oxford Road Chief Audio Office Summit a couple of weeks ago, and a huge topic was what's the definition of a podcast. And
it's really evolved. Like it's very different now.
Completely evolved. I mean, we don't even really call ourselves a podcast company. We have to show up like that in the media sometimes because certain people like classification and, you know, to kind of put you in a category, but we really just see ourselves as a media company. We're in the business of scaling IP and audience growth. And that, you know, all of our content lives across Shaw, podcast RSS, but actually YouTube channel, our distribution ecosystem by virtue of being video first is 14 airlines worldwide, Samsung TV, Techno Gym equipment, every single social platform. And we are constantly trying to discover new modes of distribution. And a lot of that is through strategic partnerships. But I think, yes, podcasting has accelerated, but also, yes, it's not necessarily new. If you think about media has always evolved for many years in terms of, let's say, print publishing onto digital publication. And it's about how do you recognize those trends, and then how do you have the humility to pivot and change your business strategy? Because something that I've definitely observed, and certainly in the podcasting landscape now, is that it's somewhat divided, let's say, ideologically or politically, if we're going to go back to my... The purists, the romantics, podcasting is audio. We must protect the traditional mode of the medium and the audio. And I kind of think, why? If you're in the business of growth, if you're a client, if you're a company, if you're anything, why are you restricting yourself to limited, outdated definitions of what is or isn't a podcast? Why aren't you having the humility to understand audience consumption behaviors are completely evolving than watching podcasts now? It's just so definitive. You know, YouTube's the number one destination for podcast consumption. And rather than, I suppose, being, I don't know what it is. Is it curiosity? Is it being brave enough? I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with change, to embrace that and then pivot the core fundamentals of their business as fast as possible to take advantage of it. I think there's a lot of romanticism taking place. I don't know if you've observed that as much in Australia, but it's, I definitely see it in the UK and the US. There's debate on my LinkedIn feed about what is a podcast. And I think, wow, we are missing the real opportunity here. If you're in the business of growth, embrace video, and because it significantly widens your distribution ecosystem. It's as simple as that. And I know we haven't got onto the chapter of Georgie and I meeting Stephen yet, but, you know, what was so powerful for Stephen is that Stephen Bartlett, for those of you who are not familiar,
that's right.
Our CEO, context is critical. He's taught me always never assume knowledge.
Yep. Correct.
And he, you know, his earliest context was scaling a social media agency called Social Chain, which went on to IPO. So his core skill set was really all around understanding social growth hacking and algorithms. And he just took that mindset to the podcasting industry. But when he started, it was a hobby and he wasn't constrained by any definition of what he thought a podcast should or shouldn't be. So there was no rule book. He just took a first principles approach to scaling content, and he knew, and this was, he started distributing on YouTube 6 years ago now. And he just took a first principles approach of what's going to be one of my biggest challenges in growing my show? Discoverability. What is going to unlock discoverability? Distribution. How can I widen my distribution? Filming it. Then I'll have a video asset that I can distribute across social and leverage all of my expertise. And it sounds so simple. And I mentioned on a podcast the other week, but I'm like, go back to first principles and we can talk about how that connects to partnerships. But people really tend to, certainly in sales, like overcomplicate things.
Yeah.
If you stick to the core fundamentals and take a first principles approach, you will scale your business. And I think, again, this will connect back to me meeting Georgie in 2020 in Acast. We kind of worked through the Acast IPO era across UK. She has a phenomenal background in editorial and publishing. I had the commercial appetite and expertise. So together, that was quite an accelerant for Acast, not to mention being ideologically aligned on the kind of purity of this long form channel. We both loved it. And then they asked us to, you know, relocate to the US to reset their US operations. And I think that was in 2022, I want to say, you know, and we speak about taking a first principles approach to scaling. So, wow, what a change. The nuances between the Australian, UK and US market
massive
are completely different.
Yep.
And I think you see in a lot of leadership styles that, let's say you've had you've had success in your career. You've been able to work up the ranks and potentially you have a bit of a fixed mindset that you think you know how to do it.
Yes.
Georgie and I took the opposite approach in the US. Mm-hmm. And I think this has been the catalyst for our entire kind of career and then growth in Flat Studio, is that we were deeply curious entering that market. Despite coming from the UK and being, let's say, the number one podcast company in the UK, we accelerated every single commercial target we had. Like the revenue growth out of the UK was absolutely phenomenal, really fueled by creativity, and also COVID timing and life plays a massive factor. And I think a lot of business leaders don't speak about that enough as well, but you need to have the humility to recognize that. COVID enabled the growth and consumption of podcasts. But okay, so we enter the US market together, a Brit and Australian leading the US team. Can you imagine if we had come in with a fixed mindset and assuming that exactly what we did to create success in the UK was exactly what the US market needed, which I think a lot of businesses actually are at a massive disadvantage. And I think it actually stems from, not to be too meta, it comes from ego.
Sure.
And when you become really successful, let's say, fast, or you keep getting promotions, you can have this like sense that I have all the answers, I know what we should do. Georgie and I entered the US market with deep curiosity, which goes back to our first principles approach of how do we scale business. Curiosity, having a genuine care factor and authenticity for what we're doing, rather than me, I had the remit of kind of resetting our entire sales strategy in the US. I'm certainly not going to arrive on day one and think that I know the answers. What transpired was a deep process of consultation with our clients and partners around exactly how they saw Acast, exactly what the barriers to entry were, and exactly what they needed. And what we learned was it was a completely different buying model in the US. They had a default towards scalability, automation, and audience addressability, which was a complete opposite to the winning formula in the UK, which was really creativity, integrated partnerships was the way that they saw podcasting. Can you imagine if we entered the market and assumed the same principles and rules applied? And again, I think that goes back to this first principle approach of curiosity. You know, it's where Stephen started with the podcast as well, getting deeply curious about how all the component parts work together, and then not assuming that there's one way to do things.
It's funny, right? This idea of the winning formula is really central to agility in leadership generally. You know, you walk into it could be a different market, like you've just described. It could be a different team. It could be a different function. It could be anything that is different, but the speed at which you can achieve an understanding on the winning formula is actually the game, right? Mm-hmm. And it actually doesn't matter what the context is that you come from. It's about the appetite to discover the winning formula. And I actually don't think that an individual can achieve that by themselves. I think it actually does take more than two or three minds to actually get to that point of view. And that's why that consultation you talk about is so important. But I've seen this hundreds, if not thousands of times where, yes, it is ego, but it's also just not the capacity to move your mind to a point that goes, I might have to unlearn everything that I came into this conversation with and just start asking some questions like I'm sitting in front of my 10-year-old daughter, who, by the way, would school me quicker than I would ever be able to do by myself.
Which is interesting because you talk about a framework, let's say, and a playbook.
Yeah.
And maybe people think there's these like really complex steps. It's not in my experience.
Nope.
It's
me neither.
Curiosity.
Yep.
First and foremost, if I would say what scales business is being deeply curious. I am really passionate about, and certainly at Flight Story, it's one of our fundamental values of high humility, low ego. Because humble people don't think they know the answers.
Yeah.
And they're willing to ask for help. They're willing to do a series of tests, which is really critical to our culture. We A/B test everything, which I'm sure we'll get to. And, you know, it's funny, playbook, systems, methodologies. No, it's typically first principles, which is curiosity, care factor scales, and definitely in sales. And we spoke about it, I think, at the top of the call. Clients and partners know if you're being authentic.
Yeah. From a mile away,
they know if you're, you know, for the context for your audience, obviously my career is being defined by, let's say, sales and commercial partnerships. They know if you are there for a transactional opportunity to try and hit your quota to be kind of somewhat self-serving.
That's it.
And I laugh about this with my team. I'm a chief revenue officer and I'm not even remotely motivated by money. I don't ever think about the quota. I don't ever, obviously I report on our numbers, but I am not in this like, obsessive
view
of the numbers. Yeah. I think about a first principles of approach of everything that we can control, showing up in a consistent way, anchored in curiosity, asking the right questions, really trying to understand what's motivating the other person, understanding their incentives, which is really important as well. I'm always encourage the team to be deeply curious around the client's world and ecosystem. Who you're speaking to is one tiny, tiny fraction of the broader equation. If you think about in the case of a chief marketing officer that I would probably have to get on board at this point, like to be bought into investing in a big, let's say, commercial partnership with us, ask the question, what's your internal approval process look like?
Yeah.
What are the steps from here? We've spent weeks together. And most of the time, it is mind-blowing how many steps that they still need to go through in terms of getting finance involved, presenting to their CFO to justify that this is a good allocation of money because capital is really important, capital to scale your company. And I think, I really celebrate any kind of, CMO that takes a lot of time in deciding the decisions of their capital allocation. And then in a lot of cases, it can go to the CEO level if it's a very significant budget investment. But how many people, and I'm sure in your career, and I'd love to hear from your perspective, how many people just don't even bother to ask?
Like everyone. Yeah. and I think the thing is that I mean that flippantly because I know there are people listening who go, I do this all the time. I feel like I'm still not getting anywhere. I feel like there are two primary questions that I ask a lot when it comes to that incentive question. Mm-hmm. One is organizational, one's personal. And the first question really is to you as the individual, if we get this partnership across the line, how will that help you in your role?
I love it.
Like, how will we make you rock star style good as a consequence of you partaking in this deal? And that's only a small part of it, right? But we ask that question of every single person we meet. Now, in my biotech experience and healthcare experience, I would ask that question of nurses and technicians and people that are so far removed from a deal. because I have a very strong bias towards the front line. So I would ask them just to get a sense, and then I'd go all the way back up. And of course, the answer is different to everyone because they've all got different internal motive, but it pieces together the web you need to understand to make it work. The second question is, what will this do for your organization, given your perspective of the organization? Now, the front line, you've got a very different one, right? You're there to do a job, get paid, maintain your employment, and hopefully be part of a great culture if that's where you work and you love being there. But if you are at the senior level, as you know, it's maybe, well, actually, we would like to make this successful because we might be able to then buy other companies. We might be able to trade differently. We might have a different reputation in market. Now, they're fundamentally different. But if you don't ask those two questions to as many people as you meet through the process of formulating a partnership, then you're going in blind. And so when people say to me, you know, so many partnerships fail, I said, no kidding, right? No one's asking the question. So the only way that you can know what to walk away from, and part of this framework we talked about at the top of the call, you know, one element of the framework I love to talk about is the next best alternative. There is always one, right? And the one that is always there is you can walk away, right? If it's not going to be ideal for you and your team. So I think there is something just very fundamental about that curiosity and never letting up. You must always be understanding that, because the day you're having a conversation with a CMO or someone at the front line, that might be one of their best days they've had that year. Most often, though, the time when you speak to them is not one of the best days in the year. So the signal you've just got there could be fundamentally misaligned from everything else you're seeing. If you're not curious, I'm not sure you're going to do very well. This is the bottom line.
I mean, I fundamentally agree with everything that you've just shared, and curiosity and empathy. Sure. And I don't think we speak about empathy enough, and it's actually connected, because you have empathy for your clients, you want the media to work. Or if you have empathy for, you know, we also do live and speaking engagements, you have empathy for that business and where they are in their stage and phase of growth. And maybe they're having challenges, hence why they're asking Stephen to come in for a motivational speech about embracing AI and technology. And empathy comes down to human connection as well, which is so important. And you can really feel if you're speaking to someone and they have empathy for who they are, they have empathy for their media objectives, let's more from like a sales lens, empathy for the business challenges that they're going through.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sure you've received briefs in your life or, RFIs, and a lot of it can be surface level, and it's about, again, having the curiosity to ask more questions. Like, what is underlying this? Why do you have a brand awareness challenge? Why aren't you converting, you know, the product sales? Why haven't you been able to, let's say, scale the revenue, as fast as possible? Maybe there's major internal structural changes, leadership changes. We are so deeply curious before we do any work with our clients. And I can't tell you how much time we spend researching before calls. And, I know you and Georgie spoke, and we spoke, you know, she shared about how much our internal team does, and, you know, the research into the depths before our podcast briefs. And we actually have the exact same approach in the commercial team, because it comes from having that deep curiosity. You're going to have such more meaningful conversation if you're on the phone with someone and you actually understand their business. And I think we've all worked in sales teams where you've been on a call with someone and I can just tell that they haven't prepared. And I'm just like, we are doing ourselves such a disservice. Not to mention now how much information, you know, the total democratization of information and access with ChatGPT and AI, you don't even need to spend the same amount of time anymore. And that's if you weren't even curious enough to do your prep work, which I also always say to the team, the first time you meet a client, my KPI for whether or not that was a successful call is that I expect you to speak the least.
Correct.
Listen, it's not about us. Do you really think that they are invested in Flight Studio, Stephen Bartlett, and Dara, the CEO? No, that's our bias. It's about them, their company always. And how many times have you seen a pitch deck and it's like slide 10 and they haven't even spoken about the company or the client or who they're speaking, who they're trying to pitch to? I'm like, this to me is wild.
Yeah, how all those signals. Yeah,
all those signals, right? Which I don't know if it's humility, empathy, but who are we to think they care about, let's say, at the Nova, Acast, and now Fight Story with Diary of a CEO and all of our other shows? I'm sure they're interested, but they don't fundamentally care about us. They care about their objectives, their incentives, their quotas, their performance review, their potential promotion, their growth of their company that will unlock their incentives. So again,
and that's only one part of the wedge, right? Like then they've got their own lives, right? So I think what I find super fascinating, and I guess I should have studied maybe things differently when I was younger. But the thing that I find fascinating is that, and Jeff Weiner talks a lot about this, a former CEO at LinkedIn. He would say, yes, I'm good for empathy. I'm better for compassion because I'm good to try and get my teams to walk in the shoes of the people we're here to serve. I'm better to want to have a bias to helping to get to that place. And that's his definition of compassion. And when we think about the partnerships on the other side, you know, one of my favorite authors on this topic is William Ury. He wrote the book Getting to Yes. He is a UN negotiator. He's been in all the hotspots around the world. He's had to deal with people who are literally ready to reach over the table and kill each other. He has found ways to help express and how to get to the point where you can understand what's actually going on in the other person's life. And it is such a competitive advantage because no one is getting out of their own invested mind, usually. Right. It's and so when you get to a point, you can sort of say, you know what, if, and this is what my teams, my previous companies, if you don't know their birthday, their kid's name, something to do with the sport they enjoy, some hobby they've got, as well as the expertise that they are doing at their work, then we really don't have a right to have a conversation with them. And by the way, before you say to me that, how do I find these things? I'm going to give you 10 minutes and an internet connection to find out, right? Because all of this is available enough. You know, I'm sure you've seen this before, and I've seen a number of the gifting things that go on, the internal process that goes on at Flight Geo, and all of the things that happen to make the culture what it is. Mm-hmm. And the number of times that care has been taken to make the individual feel like they are the center of attention, if only people realize that this is how commerce works. This is how true commerce works, right? And so it's not hard to do it. It's just that people are trying to create an excuse as to why they don't want to know that. And I think it's because they're getting in their own way. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to be said for how you and your team have done this, because a lot of the marketing that has been attempted before to build big brands and to get to the point. I mean, the reason Nestle is Nestle, the reason that Lego is Lego, are for a whole range of reasons which are frankly fundamentally irrelevant today, mm-hmm. right? Those things just wouldn't work in the markets we're in today. So that curiosity is something else. I want to jump quickly to where you pitched Stephen using his own tactic.
Yes. So I guess to thread that needle, Georgie and I moved to the US. We then depart Acast at the time. And I think to start our own venture at the time, and Georgie's already covered this off, it was a podcast media agency inspired by the performance marketing model. We learned about the US because we were deeply curious, didn't assume that the same rules applied market by market. So Georgie and I guess were brave enough to leave our exec roles, resigned from Acast, you know, with a stable salary and package, mm-hmm. and bet on ourselves, which I think is really important for any person's journey around, again, going back to pivoting and having the courage to do so. And then we launched our business, you know, we invested our own capital in doing that. It was called Telling Media at the time. And we won a series of our first clients, and you know, our small business was on a positive upward trajectory, but you know, it was only 4 months old. And then Stephen posted on LinkedIn, Stephen Bartlett, that, yeah, he had ambitions of launching what he was calling at that time a network after the phenomenal success of Diary of a CEO. And he had such high conviction that the success behind the growth of his show had very little to do with him as a gifted communicator and interviewer. Again, goes back to humility, underpins our business, and more to do with the classic iceberg analogy, more to do with the systems and processes and culture that he had created, a culture of experimentation, a culture that we, our default assumption is to say, I don't know. A culture that enables us to kill the guesswork, and rather than trying to make creative or editorial decisions based on gut instinct, that we actually have empathy for our audience. We create a series of tests in terms of, you know, testing naming conventions, thumbnails, in terms of different titling, and then get the signals and real life feedback loop from the audience to tell us exactly what they're interested in, exactly how they wanted to be marketed to. So he thought, no, it's not about me. It's about this culture of experimentation and humility that I've built. And he really felt high conviction that it was repeatable. Of course, Georgie and I have both worked in the global podcasting industry. We're very intrigued by his LinkedIn post. He's saying it was an open call for anyone to contact him that felt that they could add value to podcast media, and he was looking for his founding team. And it goes back to everything we're talking about. First principles, do your research, be deeply curious, speak to them in their language, understand who they are, care factor scales, curiosity scales. I had watched every single episode of Diary of a CEO ever published, just by chance. I was already an avid consumer, again, because it had just the lessons that he has taught me in business and life. And I had read his book. I had consumed a lot of his content, and the subject line in the email. Keep in mind that we were competing with 35,000 people. We now know in the inbox that he scrolled through, and the subject line was speaking to him in his own language. It was dragged or driven. Either way, we're scaling the global podcast industry, and dragged or driven. He speaks about that at the time in every episode. Are these formidable CEOs and founders and leaders dragged by, let's say, earliest context or some level of low-T trauma to success, or are they driven? And I knew that that was something that he was deeply passionate about and curious. So, again, speak to him in layman's terms. The second line was, no formal intros, no habituation filter, everything you need to know to make a fast decision. What's that? He speaks about habituation filter in his podcast content. He's very passionate about it, that in marketing, every brand is starting to sound the same. And then everything you need to know to make a fast decision, empathy. Stephen is incredibly time poor. I'm not going to have the perception that he is ever going to want to read a long email from two people that he's never met. Because think about their incentives, think about their world. And again, I wasn't even thinking about that at the time. It's just how Georgie and I have always worked together and built our company and our business as a first principles approach to curiosity and empathy, because I now have access to the inbox and I see what so many other people are doing. And it's like these long-winded essays. And yeah. Come on, like, get it. I was about to say, get a grip, but no one's reading your long essay.
Nope.
And you better believe one of the busiest and most successful entrepreneurs in the world doesn't have time to read an essay. Like, you've got to get to the point and try to be succinct.
That's it.
So it's kind of nice because it's obviously wrapping around the subject and the themes that we spoke about. But I see people who reach out to Stephen in the inbox, and it's so clear that they've never listened to the podcast. They don't read his book. They haven't followed him on his socials. He's so clear about what he cares about.
Yeah.
He's giving you his psychological drive, his business drive, his personal motivations. He's very, very open and honest about his background of coming from, being one of the only black kids in a working class neighborhood, and the fact that that has always kind of given him this struggle, and hence why he says he's dragged or driven. I think he had that kind of chip on his shoulder that he wanted to prove that he could. And so he tells you exactly what his intrinsic motivations are. They're open in the world. So ultimately, if you're not spending the time or being curious enough to, look for the signals, then I can kind of see why a lot of the emails don't cut through. But, obviously there's still, and I want to go back to this, it's really important. There's an element of chance and luck. I love it. Kevin O'Leary spoke about this on the podcast with Stephen. So did Scott Galloway. I don't think any leader in the world would say that they haven't had. Obviously, we were lucky that potentially Stephen was, maybe he had a couple of hours in his schedule that day that weren't blocked. Maybe he was on a plane in that exact moment in time and we got 3 hours where he was scanning the inbox. And just through luck and chance, you know. So there's an element of obviously do your
sure, of
preparation
course.
And be curious. But, you know, again, we'll have the humility enough to know, wow, there must have been forces at play that were, you know, in our favor as well. And that can scale businesses. You know, you spoke about COVID. That was a huge accelerant for podcasting at Acast.
Yeah, massive.
Because other modes of production shut down. And so we saw rapid fire growth in consumption. Yep. And then obviously all the advertising dollars followed. So it's kind of an oxymoron because I'm saying you can control it, do the preparation, be deeply curious and empathetic, but also be humble enough to acknowledge there's an element of luck in all of this. Right.
Yeah, of course. In time. Of course. Yeah. And I think, you know, you look at, I think opportunity is a function of luck and preparation, right? These are the things that come together to make it work. A friend of mine, Ryan Hawke, who has a fantastic podcast in the States, The Learning Leader Show. I remember reaching out to him. I've listened to every one of his podcasts before I started, and I reached out and said, listen, would you come on my podcast? And we had three episodes. He said, sure, when do you want to do it? And it was like, really? So really quick back and forth, one of the most transformative experiences that sort of put us on the trajectory we were on. And without that, that wouldn't have happened. Similar kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I came prepared. He came prepared. Amazing conversation. Change the game. That's the biggest part of it.
I love what you said there. And I've been really fortunate enough to meet, I think, through the podcast, the guests. So Stephen has certainly in the kind of early episodes, some of the biggest, most high profile founders and CEOs on the podcast. And the connective tissue in all of them is that they're actually quite humble.
Yeah.
Low ego.
Yep.
High humility. And they, because it's kind of easy to, when you get to such a point of such success, it's kind of easy to maybe claim that you are the, you know, it was driven by an individual, your unique skill set and expertise and experience, your judgment and your decision making. And I was like, wow, listening, consuming all those podcast episodes and then getting to meet a lot of these people, I was like, wow, you would think they would be, you know, I guess arrogant's not the right word, but, you know, like very,
very sure of themselves.
Yes, very sure of themselves. But actually, the humility. Wow. And Stephen, absolutely. You know, he's the biggest, one of the biggest content creators in the world. You know, certainly arguably one of the most culturally relevant and popular at the time. And if you were to ask him about a content trend or the guest he should have in the podcast or how he should market it, he says, I don't know.
Mm. Yep.
But I'm going to conduct a series of tests.
So refreshing. Yeah. I mean, what people might not know is that you have somebody who is responsible for failure.
Yeah. Yes.
And experimentation. And that for me is, that is the epitome of what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the person, I remember, I think I've forgotten her name. It was the first appointment that I remember seeing come up. And the whole team was so proud of the fact that that title had been awarded.
Yes.
It's something else.
Well, we fundamentally believe that, you know, failure is feedback, and the more feedback you have, you know, the faster your rate of experimentation and failure, the faster your learnings, and then those learnings compound over time. And then what was a show for, let's say, 2 years that was on a relatively kind of flat growth trajectory, by year three, the compounding effect of all of those failures and learnings, fastest growing podcast brand in the world, second only to Joe Rogan in a space of 5 years. And it took time. So delayed gratification is critical with leadership. Scaling companies, not making short-term tactical decisions out of kind of like, let's say, fear or scarcity mindset of the bottom line or your sales quota, but being prepared to have delayed gratification. Stephen is the embodiment of delayed gratification. Mm. It was year three, I think, before it accelerated. She said 3 years, still testing, still experimenting, still showing up, and just through a belief that the rate of compounding returns when you commit to
the
1% marginal gains over time. That's it's the same in investing, right? I think Warren Buffett was the OG of understanding delayed gratification.
Got to keep showing up. Christiana, I'm just going to earmark this right now. I feel as though we need a second episode.
I would love to. I feel like we've barely scratched this.
I've got like another 10, 15 questions to go. But tell me this. So, you know, we talk about this idea of growth. People hear words which skirt around the idea that money is exchanging hands or being earned. And as somebody who understands media extremely well, understands, you know, what it's worth, how value is exchanged, how people perceive value, you know, everything from the fundamentals around all the funnel types and what needs to go on for people to feel, the advertisers and supporters in particular, they can feel as though it's actually working. Can we talk a little bit about the cadence or maybe the approach that your team takes to identifying, pitching, and creating not just here, go and buy a bunch of ads, but how do we create sort of an experience for these brands? Because I know Stephen in particular is very specific about the brands that he partners with and who he mm-hmm. invests with, and he's got his own things there and also the things inside Flight Story. But you've also got a series of other shows that are being continually produced, which are not Stephen Bartlett, and they're not of his ilk. They're connected, of course, but they're not the same. So for people who have never been in the commercial money-making side of a machine like this, can you pull back the curtain a bit and sort of help explain what that process is and what exactly goes on to make sure that an organization like yours can grow at the rate that it's growing? Because it takes capital. It's expensive. There's realities to this. Can you help us understand a bit more about that?
I guess I'll approach the question from two perspectives. First, a look behind the curtain, and again, it all goes back to curiosity and I suppose not accepting that the way to commercialize a podcast business is a fixed way. It's predominantly advertising income. Well, actually, here we have a creator economy. So we have five podcasts now. So with Stephen and our first five signings, or some of the previous highest performing guests, or Diary of a CEO of all time. You know, if I came with my fixed mindset of the last 10 years in media, I would say and recommend to the business, advertising is our number one income stream, and it'll be sponsorship and it'll be ads and it'll be branded content. No, let's get deeply curious. Who are these people? Wow, they're creators, but they're actually subject matter experts. They're thought leaders. Let's look at the widening monetization potential. If I don't necessarily look at them like a media property, but credentialized thought leaders. And then herein lies, we open up live events and corporate speaking, a whole new industry that I was really first only exposed to via Flight Studio and the Diary of a CEO. And that speaks to the fact that we're dealing with subject matter experts, not necessarily just, let's say, celebrities and media personalities. So, okay, let's get curious about that. What kind of live experiences and speaking engagements can we create, leveraging the same power of that expertise to help enable people? It goes back to the mission of our whole company. And then, okay, well, what is the audience telling us around, you know, we distribute on multiple different platforms, so we have such a strong feedback loop with our audience. And then we also have subscriptions and newsletters, so a lot of first-party data acquisition that allows us to ask them, again, have empathy, ask them what they want. Wow, we have a feedback loop where I can ask almost 11 million consumers now what they want, and that then helps us in our product and e-commerce division at Flight Studio, because we've cultivated an audience, we've focused on growth, and then we have a system design that we're getting constant feedback loop from them. And then, wow, isn't that an interesting opportunity to then build products that we can then market back to our consumers? And these products are still true to our company about having a positive psychological impact on the end user, all of our podcast content. So that's what we've done in our product and e-com team. It's all around helping build products that close the enablement loop for some of the kind of positive changes and tools that we're trying to encourage them to make. We have a 1% brand. It's called 1% Diary, that helps keep people kind of accountable and on track to their goals. Our conversation cards as well, which is all about sparking curiosity and asking the right questions. See how it's all connected?
Yeah, and definitely. And it makes a whole match of sense. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And then we have also it's called platform monetization. So again, getting deeply curious about the partners that we already have. So we have a partnership with YouTube. We partner with TikTok, Instagram, Meta, Snapchat, X. Very curious. What are your incentives? How do your businesses make money? Those conversations. Oh, well, we have a objective right now that we want more video content on our platform to serve in stream ads. If I didn't have those conversations with all of these third party social platforms, I wouldn't go, wow, we have long form video content. We could cut this up and serve you highly engaging clips that then, you know, serve their business objective. And that is our fastest growing income stream, this social indirects. It's incredible. You know, you can cut up video clips and then monetize it across other platforms. So again, if I think about how we've created our commercial ecosystem and architecture, I'm just connecting these dots now. It's all anchored in partnerships.
Yep.
We have partnerships with all of our creators, understanding who they are, what motivates them, what drives them, and then also understanding how their other platforms that we partner with that are kind of critical to our distribution, how do they make money? What are their incentives? How can we help enable them?
Yes.
And the classic case of 1 + 1 = 3. And then when it goes back to how we think about structuring these partnerships, again, we believe in delayed gratification from an advertiser sense. We're not going to say yes. We're not going to accept a campaign if it's not authentic, if we don't believe that the host is going to have a genuine endorsement. You know, like, lots changes and at the same time everything stays the same, that beautiful saying that yep. Fundamentally in podcasting you're capitalizing on the social currency and affinity between the host and the listener relationship. So we really, really, you know, are so intentional about that. So
when if you look back on the time with the partners you've got right now, for the ones you've been with for a little bit of time now, what would you say would be the average, I don't want to use the term tenure, but the average sort of relationship span of those partners?
Minimum 2 to 3 years. So for Diary of a CEO right now, yep, every Perfect. Single partner has renewed. Every yep. single partner has renewed for a third year in a row when they started commercializing it in a more meaningful way. And that's because he has a first principle approach to low ad loads. I don't know if yes. you saw in the... I'm sure you may or may not have seen the Forbes piece about us rejecting $100 million minimum guarantee deal.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I saw that. Yep. Yep.
This is all connected. That MG deal came at the expense of having to enable 12 ad slots and totally
kind
of erode. Yes. Yep. But on paper, don't they look very appealing? But if you're committed to this sense of delayed gratification, of having empathy for your partners and audiences, mm-hmm. we felt that it would impact the AVD, average view duration. It would impact yeah. the listener retention and the engagement. And that's not a trade-off we were willing to make. Hence the power yeah. of also walking away if it's not ideologically aligned.
That's but it.
It's a lot easier to have a short-term mindset there. Again, it's hopefully all of this comes out in the edit, but there's a lot of connections.
Oh no, I don't think we have to edit much of this. I mean, let me. It's interesting how this is all playing out. Can you humor me on this framework and just see if we can run through this once and just see where this is at?
Okay.
So, how are you for time? By the way, we'll chop this bit.
I'm okay. My next meeting's at 11:30, so I've got 20 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Still have to do a second episode, by the way, but we'll get to that.
Love to. and I'm really curious about your playbook as well. I would love to actually learn a bit more.
This is retrospectively built, right? It's based on the history of all the things that I saw, which it seems as though is more applicable than I thought. So the word ideal. And this is something where I still go down walk down the corridors of my client organizations. And I've heard people say, which blew my mind, I'm not sure that that is ideal. They're talking about a deal they're going to do. And they're using that vernacular as a cultural exchange and a heuristic to say, let's not do this or let's do this, which is beyond wonderful when you sort of come up with something like this. So the letter I, is there shared intent? And that intent goes to your point around curiosity, but is it written down, right? Not does this live in the ether? Do the two parties that are coming together, and there's this tool that we built, which is like a 5-page slide deck. It's an internal sales doc, basically, that sort of shows how we'll work together, how we'll build trust over 3 steps, what is the language we're going to use, and what are the next steps to close? Like, how do we make that work so everyone's on the same page? So that's I. D is for dual benefit. So in every partnership that we oversee, every partner has to have at least 2 benefits, not just one. And depending on the partner, it doesn't need to be both financial. It doesn't need to be both halo. There can be a whole range of different things, but it has to be relevant for them. So that's D. E stands for era. And this is the timing question. Mm. For a great partnership to start, it's got to have the space to breathe over a 3-year period, yes. because too much happens in between, right? And I'm really not a fan of an annual recurring situation. It's just not, it's not practical to the intention of what people are trying to do in the short, in the medium and long term. A is for allies. And in a large enterprise sort of circumstance, I really like to see that each team has got five allies on the other side of the table that they can work with, riff on, and get sort of intelligence and build a culture of care and exchange. Because as we both know, when somebody leaves an organization, if that's the single point sensitivity you have, then that relationship essentially just falls apart. So there's a way to sort of build a scaffold around that. And I think five is a good number. Could be three, but five is good. L stands for landing the first win. And this is the thing that, in my view, brings an end to most partnerships. This is something very material that a company lands for their partner to prove that it was worth doing the deal in the first place. So if you and I were on the other side of a table from each other and we were trying to work out the best way to make our companies work together, I would be saying to you, what is the deal that I can offer you in the next 6 months that will prove internally when I'm not in the room that you took the right bet on our business? And I use this sort of playing card analogy where it's essentially you are going to put down a promise card, right? And a promise card is your professional reputation to say, I think company A is worth doing a deal with. This is usually when somebody else doesn't see the value. Company A, the best way they can return the favor is to completely over-deliver what they said they were going to do to make you look awesome. Because now you get to pick up that promise card, you get to take it back, put it back in your deck, and you can play that another day. But we only get a limited number of these cards, right? So if you play too many, your reputation becomes eroded and you really can't do the things you wanted to try and do. So landing the first win, super important. That's the word ideal. But like we talked about top of the call, then there is this idea of, well, what is your next best alternative? And so we put a little plus at the top of ideal, and that is, if it's not going to work, you always have an alternative. That alternative is to not proceed. But it adds the element of timing, because all those elements around ideal, they could all work out fine, right? But do we have a next best alternative? If the answer is we don't, I mean, you genuinely believe you don't, then the chance you're going to negotiate from a place of fear and not of abundance and opportunity and upside is very, very high. So what you want to do, at least have the mindset that if this doesn't go the way we want to, no matter how much we've invested in trying to get to this point, we can still walk away and that'd be cool.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That is such a fantastic framework. That's what I love, the curiosity to have a conversation with you today and to now listen and hear that. And yeah, it's such a fantastic way to structure it. And I think this idea of mutually beneficial partnerships. So again, in commercial teams, you could have a tendency to want to negotiate and win.
Yes.
But what is, and this is something really interesting, and I probably think, and I can have my own personal reflection here, like maybe I wanted to be the better negotiator or have better terms when I was younger. And they're kind of inconsequential over the long haul, but maybe I wanted the dopamine hit of a win, a feeling like that I out-intellectualized or something, and it goes back to the politics. But actually now I'm like, 1 + 1 must equal 3. Yeah. And understanding they absolutely should be mutually beneficial. And it goes back to, you're not going to scale your company, your sales team, your commercial quota, if you'll have this short-term mindset of what's in it for you. It again goes back to clients can feel that in authenticity or partnerships or big platforms. And I have never felt such high conviction that the best partnerships are truly mutually beneficial. And maybe you've both had to concede on some terms, but ultimately everyone's leaving the room feeling really happy. That's not it. Feeling like they paid too much or they didn't get all of the access that they wanted, or maybe we haven't been able to, Yeah, I resonate with it so much, and I have that personal reflection of like, wow, I've been on my own journey of realizing you don't need to win every term, but you can see, I think by people in commercial have a default to probably being a little bit competitive and wanting to win.
Yeah, I think that is the salesperson's thing, right? There's a lot of culture built around that. But let me ask you this. How many of the partners that you've done deals with that have persevered would you be the first call that they would make when things were going sideways? Now, I'm going to hazard a guess to say it's a reasonably high number.
Yeah, I would say almost all of them.
Right. So that's actually the mark. Right now, you talk about delayed gratification, and this is super important in this context. If you are the first person that somebody calls from another organization when things are not going well, that's where you've won. But that's the winning formula in this game. Yes, the deal terms have got to be strong. People can't lose money on things. There's got to be upside. There's got to be a way to celebrate all of those things. But I actually believe that if you're the person they're going to call, that will carry with you no matter where you are in your professional life.
Do you know what I love about that as well? It speaks to the power of social currency in human relationships. You know, you see a lot of kind of sales marketing at the moment of like SaaS models, AI, automation, systems. We can build a client pitch for, you know, you won't ever have to build a client pitch again. It'll all be AI and automated, and you can scale your deal flow and scale your volume of outreach. Yes, those tools help, but if you don't have human connection, if you don't spend the time getting to know people, again, all goes back to these first principles, empathy, curiosity.
Yep.
You know, it's probably inconvenient to me to fly to the US as often as I do from like a personal life perspective, but I know how important it is to meet those partners and be there
Absolutely.
In person.
Absolutely. Yep.
Stephen turned up for a speaking engagement with one of our biggest media agencies the other week that he did, you know, let's say, you know, pro bono because he has empathy for all of the people in that room and how much they've invested in him and how much that, even though it's inconvenient, and the power of human connections and social currency, which let's go full circle, is podcasting.
Yeah.
It's the ultimate human connective tissue. And without that, again, I always, you know, you see a lot of sales companies that are like kind of doubling down in AI and automation. And I get the emails now. A lot of people, a lot of platforms or companies are probably like pitching to work with us. And I'm like, I know you didn't. It feels so inauthentic and too automated. Yep. Talk about the habituation filter. Now AI runs the risk of everyone sounding the same and everyone pitching the same because
it's already sounding that way.
Yeah, can look on everything ever published online about the partner and you, and they will find some way to have, let's say, a sweet spot that's emphasized in the email.
Yep.
Every single pitch will be completely homogenized and sound the same.
That's it. I am going to stop right now.
Okay.
on the commitment that we're going to do episode 2 on this,
please.
Man, have I got some questions to still run through here.
Me too.
So everyone, we are going to pause this and we will do our best to get together as quick as we can to have the second conversation. Christiana Benton, part 1, this has been great and I'm looking forward to the second bit.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to the 5 questions in the second round.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes-Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.